A pretty busy show. Tuesday, January 11th, 2022 on Connecticut Today. We took a close look at what's really in the so-called voting rights bill that's currently being promoted by Senate Democrats. I read down a list of what's in there. Some of the stuff was surprising. State House GOP leader Vin Candelora of North Brantford called in to update the continuing process of realigning Connecticut's five U.S. House seats that could affect Shelton and Waterbury, among four or five cities and towns. Journal Inquirer of Manchester columnist Chris Powell used his monthly visit to take State Treasurer Sean Wooden to task for a program that manages unclaimed property in the state. I want to start out with this because you're going to get this now for the next, about the next 5 or 6 days, because the Democrats in Congress, and that, of course, includes Messrs. Murphy and Blumenthal in the Senate here, and Jim Himes and Rosa DeLauro and Joe Courtney and John Larson and Johanna Hayes, our House delegation, they're all going to be pumping their fists and cheering for a massive bill. Now, the Democrats are calling this, the Democrats are calling this a voting rights bill. So they're calling this a voting rights bill. Now, right off the front, right off the hopper, that's a misnomer. It's got nothing to do with the right to vote. Everybody in this country, in the good old US of A, if you are a legal resident of the United States of America, if you are a legal citizen here in good standing, and you are registered in your state, if you know where your polling place is, if you know what district you should be registered in, if you have the proper identification, and if you know when the elections are, nobody is denying your right to vote. So the notion that they're selling this as a voting rights bill is ludicrous. It's laughable. Now, I know this other stuff we'll get into here in a moment, but first, right off the hopper, this has nothing to do with voting rights. Millions and millions and millions of people in every state of all colors, ethnicities, creeds, they exercise their rights or rights to vote every 2 years. They are conscientious voters. They are registered. They have proper identification. They have taken the initiative. I know that's a dirty word sometime now in society, but they've taken the initiative and they said, hey, there are some responsibilities on my end here to make sure I'm registered, to make sure I'm a citizen, to make sure I have the proper identification, to make sure that I know where my polling place is. And how about this? To make sure that if there's anything wrong with anything I mentioned here, to get it corrected, because, geez, I don't know about you folks, mom and dad out there, boys and girls, grandma and grandpa, elections don't sneak up on you. They don't. I'm sorry. They just don't. Whether it's a municipal election, a statewide election, a federal election for the presidency on down to members of Congress, a local state legislator, a mayor, a first selectman, a first select woman, whatever. If you have a pulse, if you're paying attention, if you're conscientious, if you get your head out of your phone and out of other regions for a few minutes, the elections happen once every 2 years, not 2 weeks, not 2 days, not 2 months. Barring a special election, the elections happen once every 2 years. So you've got 2 years to figure something out. If something is awry, say, hey, I'm moving, or I'm not sure who my member of Congress is, or I'm not sure which state house, state assembly, state senate district I live in, or my mom lives in, or my son or daughter lives in. You've got time, father time, and maybe Mrs. or mother time too. All the time is on your side to fix this. Okay, Ella, again, you don't wake up in the morning and say, oh, look at that. I put that on my calendar. Yeah, they scheduled an election 2 days ago. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't. So the idea that this is a voting rights bill is a charade. It's a canard. It's a head fake here. What this bill actually does is to wrestle away, because the Democrats did this when they were in Congress, when they took control of the House coming up on 3 years ago. It wrestles away a lot of state and local control over elections. And, of course, they're wrapping this up with a big fat holiday bow tie. This is wrapped up in January 6th, because if we don't do this, January 6th will continue, which is a load of crap. And they know it, too. Now, you may say, what's in the bill, Paul, that's so bad? Well, I'll tell you, because what I like to do on this show is to find out exactly what is in bills. Because do you ever notice, no matter how many news channels we have, left, right, and center, no matter how many news channels we have, no matter how many publications you can access online, whether it's mainstream papers or auxiliary press or these little microsites, it's still not that easy for the average voter to find out what exactly is in these bills. The same thing with the Build Back Better stuff, which had stuff about immigration in it and a lot of stuff about nonsensical stuff about the environment there, which, okay, are all valid issues. They need to be done in separate bills. Aha! But we can't do that because a lot of the stuff we have to hide. Don't say too much about it, because they'll say this bill is about X on top, because those dummy voters only read the headline. So we'll hide all the stuff that we really want to get passed in there. So we'll come back and we'll talk about the stuff that's actually in this bill that, of course, the president, everybody on down, Senator Blumenthal, Congressman Himes are all going to bloviate about for the next week about how we have to save democracy and this, that, and the other. So again, just as a happy little public service that I like to do on this show, just letting you know that you're going to be hearing a lot about a voting rights bill over the next few days and about how nobody has the right to vote and those evil Republican states want to take us back to Jim Crow and this and the other. And please stop. And we're going to hear about it from Dick Blumenthal and Chris Murphy and Jim Himes and Rosa DeLauro and Johanna Hayes and John Larson and Joe Courtney. And it's vaudevillian sometimes. It's so funny because this has nothing to do with voting rights. Millions and millions and how many people voted the votes did we count in last election? 81 million to 74, 77, like 160 million people voted and had their votes count. So the notion that we have to have a new voting rights bill is absurd. It's ludicrous. Now, I know what you're saying. Well, Paul, there are, you know, some efforts to suppress the vote. Okay, if you think that's in play in your state, in your locale, in your city, in your precinct, then you know what? That's what we have the court system for. We use the third branch of government. We have a court system, a local court, district courts, federal level courts, the appellate bench, the U.S. Supreme Court. We have courts that adjudicate and look at complaints from one or two individuals all the way up through legislators. And in the middle, you have interest groups who happily take cases of voter intimidation and alleged illegal activity in votes. So that's what that's there for. You do not say, well, we need sweeping federal control of the vote. No, you don't do that. That's not how this was set up. So if we look at these For the People Act, H.R. 1 here, I guess they're going to be considering or Mr. Schumer in the Senate wants to, now they're going to do a carve-out of the filibuster. So they're not going to rewrite the rules of the filibuster per se, because they know what a cluster this is. They're not going to rewrite the rules, they say, to completely get rid of the filibuster, because Democrats know that it'd be committing some level of political suicide here. They know that. Now they're going to do a carve-out. They're trying to massage Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin and some other queasy Democrats, saying, oh, come on, let's just do a carve-out here for a voting rights bill. It's insanity. It's ludicrous. It's like the kid that you played, touch football, sandlot baseball, softball, street baseball, automatics. Remember, if it hits the car, it's a double. And you always have one or two of those kids. Well, no, let's change the rules. Let's make it like if it hits Mrs. Smith's roof, it's like a triple, but it's got to bounce over there. No, no. The rules are the rules are the rules. So, just a few things here that are in this bill. So if this so-called voting rights bill were to pass, now, some of this stuff may get fine-tuned. Some of the stuff may get pulled out of the bill. Here's what's in there. The first thing, one of the first things, prohibits states from requiring an excuse to vote absentee. Like Connecticut, for example, the Constitution of the state of Connecticut says you have to be in one of six specific criteria to request an absentee ballot. Sickness, infirmary, you're going to be out of town, you're working another polling place, you're in a branch of the military and won't be local. You know, we've talked about this ad nauseum. Well, this federal bill would prohibit states like Connecticut from simply requiring that a prospective user of an absentee ballot fit in one of a set of categories. Really? I wonder why they want to do that. They should call that the Park City provision. They should call that the Bridgeport provision. Why do they do that, huh? Second thing, requiring states to mail absentee ballot applications to all voters. Gee, I wonder why that's in the bill. Huh? Yeah? You overwhelm the system, flood the system, just like they do with the border? Jeez. You wonder why that's in the bill. That could also be a Bridgeport addendum there. Require states to allow voters to apply for absentee ballots online. Okay, you might convince me of that. What's the security level going to be of online ballot applications? And I know some of you out there say, well, geez, you're always anticipating the worst. Well, here's my point. We in society demand a certain level of security, a certain level of identification, a certain level of responsibility when you're doing things like banking and getting a mortgage and buying something, simply like cashing a check or having to get into a building now or a common area in COVID. We keep increasing things on one end while over the years we keep making it, shall I say, a little more, lax on the voting end. What do you think of all this? 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. I guess the question is here, should the federal government come in and strip many powers of voting and election administration away from individual states? Should the feds, initiated by Congress here, have more power over elections under the guise of voting rights? Going to get an update here as to what's going on with the process that has been given a couple of more days now by the so-called special master, a professor at Stanford University, for both sides to redraw the congressional districts in the state, and the gentleman who's been kind enough to keep us updated on this process, Republican House Leader Vin Candelora of North Brantford, who's had a handle in this or hand in this. Once again, Vin, hi, it's Paul. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Well, Vin, yeah, thank you, Vin. And I know it's kind of been a slog here. So the court, what, extended you folks and the special master of the court said, what, try another couple of days? That was like a day ago, right?
Yeah, that's right. There was a public hearing on Monday, and the court has asked that Republicans and Democrats on the commission over the next 48 hours, try to come up with an agreement.
So that ends the deadline as far as their eyes, Vin, is what, the end of tomorrow? Is that the 48-hour end?
I guess so. I mean, I'm not sure really the special master has technically the authority to do it. I mean, we certainly have begun talks again to try to come up with an agreement, but ultimately the Supreme Court has left it in the hands of the special master to draw the map. And my guess is what is sort of different from 10 years ago is he has two maps that are very similar to each other. And so I think he feels that we are so close that why can't we just come to an agreement? So let me give them another opportunity to try to do that.
Now, Vin, the elephant in the room, and you and I have talked about this, but just for folks who may first be hearing us or realize what's going on here, the elephant in the room, Vin, is some adjustments in the eastern part of the state, but more important to the people in my listening area, the 25 or so thousand voters, correct, that have to come out presently of what's the 4th district, right?
That's right. And I think, you know, the biggest elephant in the room is to what degree do these elected congressmen have the right to veto any map that this commission comes up with? You know, we are sort of an independent commission. We take the incumbents' input, but it seems that they're all sort of arguing among themselves over what portions of towns that they want to actually accept. And so the sticking point lies more so with the congressional delegation, I think, than it does really with the reapportionment commission. And until, you know, we could really have a conversation with those congresspeople, you know, no one likes change, but change has to happen. And so even when you want to make incremental change, change is change. And we're seeing that struggle among them. And I think there's a reluctance on the Democrats' part to step in and put their foot down.
Well, and Vin, it was interesting, and you and I talked about this previously. I think Speaker Matt Ritter here in the state, Vin, said a couple of weeks ago, he alluded to pressures from outside. So it sounds like that's what Speaker Ritter, at least on a state level, Vin, that sounds like he's alluding to what you're saying.
Yeah, what's sort of funny about it is that if you look at the Democrat map or the Republican map, both proposals are within the margin of error. Like, we are talking about minor percentage point changes in the performances of all these districts. So the districts are not going to change by virtue of the maps. They're going to change by virtue of the electability of these candidates. And so I think that Democrats are scared coming into this cycle, given what we are seeing out of the federal government and all their failures. And so rather than running on their records, they want to try to maximize their reelections by drawing a map that's favorable to them. And the problem is all five of our congressmen can't be winners. And so they all really just need to run on their own record and step away from the process.
Vin, and by the way, Vin Candelora is the guest, State House Republican leader, North Brantford, who's been involved in the attempt anyway to redistrict the state's five congressional districts. Vin, would you say the reporting that has been particularly in the Connecticut News Junkie has been accurate in and of the fact that the Democrats and the Republicans, you guys basically agree on Glastonbury, Middletown, and Shelton, and the difference for the Democrats is Torrington, and the difference for the GOP is Waterbury? Is that reporting been accurate, Vin?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much right. I think of the 169 towns, we have an agreement on 164 of them. And the disputes revolve around the borders in Torrington, Waterbury, maybe Shelton still, and Middletown. and a little bit of Glastonbury. So they're all just really sort of incremental differences that we do have.
The claw, then, and a lot of people know about the claw, some don't. I was pointing that out to some friends of mine the other day, and they looked at it and they go, "What?" And I said, "Well, that's actually there." Is the claw, then, that leaks in from the 1st District to the 5th, upper north of Waterbury into Litchfield, Torrington, is the claw going to live, then? Will it be slain or will it be reduced in size? What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's probably going to live, but we would like to see it be reduced a little by having the 5th absorb Torrington. Torrington is the urban center of the northwest corner of the state. And so to suggest that Torrington should be paired up with Hartford and New Britain is a bit bizarre to us. And so if there's a chance to sort of eat away at the claw, we think that's where it should be taken away from, and that the Torrington should – all of it should go in the 5th. Right now, only a portion of it is in the 5th.
What are you hearing, Vin, if anything? What did you hear, both sides, you and your Democratic compadres there, what did you hear from the folks that were able to get through in the type of public hearing you had, or emails, phone calls, stuff on Zoom? What are you hearing?
You know, I think COVID has sort of impacted this process. We don't hear a lot from the public about it. I think a lot of the testimony we heard came from elected officials and people that sort of have a vested interest in the maps. You know, generally speaking, I think in the public, when they look at that map, you know, it does scream of gerrymandering with that claw being there. And I think a lot of people don't understand why that can't be fixed. But all in all, there hasn't been a lot of robust discussion about these maps in the general public.
Finally, this special master, Nathaniel Persily, I believe, Vin, is an authority and a professor of election law at Stanford University. What are your thoughts about him, your encounters with him? I don't really recognize his name. I did see he seems quite qualified. What are your thoughts on his possible role in all this? And have you had any encounters with him?
Yeah, I mean, he seems pretty thoughtful, and I have not had any encounters with him. We were only allowed to have two members of the commission testify, so I was not one of them. The chairs had testified all in all. But I think he's reluctant to want to do this job. But what people should understand is that the Supreme Court, when they hired this special master to draw the map, they've indicated that he should draw the least restrictive change as possible. So he's instructed to sort of only make incremental changes to the map. And that's why the claw is probably here to stay for another decade, unfortunately. And, you know, the process is frustrating right now because I think least change is just not good for these congressional districts. And hopefully at some point when we get a Republican in Congress, we could make changes that make sense for the residents, especially in the northwest corner.
Vin Candelora. Vin, thank you. Good luck over the next day or two, and we'll keep an eye on this. Vin, thanks.
Thank you. Take care.
All right, there you go. State House Speaker, rather, State House Minority Leader, not the Speaker, the Minority Leader, Republican Leader Vin Candelora, who was in the middle of this whole thing. So, yeah, he says the reporting on this has been accurate. So, again, folks, two maps submitted, one from the Republicans, one from the Democrats. Largely, he said they agree on 164 of 169 cities or towns. There would be small changes to Middletown, Glastonbury, and Shelton. So I believe most of Shelton's in the 3rd. So part of Shelton's going to end up, I guess, in the 4th, perhaps, or maybe the 5th. And then the bigger changes, the proposed changes, would be Torrington and Waterbury. So in our immediate area here, you folks in Torrington, Waterbury, and Shelton, keep an eye out and ear out, and we'll keep you updated on this right here on WICC. The next gentleman, a regular on our show, we check in with him at least once a month. He's probably, in my mind, the best columnist, op-ed guy in the state who points out things that need discussion. And here he is right now, Chris Powell from the Journal Inquirer of Manchester. Hey, Chris, it's Paul. How are you?
Hey, great to be with you, Paul.
Great to be with you, Chris. Thanks once again. You wrote a piece regarding the state treasurer, Sean Wooden, and you reacted to a piece that was done by another organization, and it brings up something, Chris, that when you and I were growing up, I was pointing out on the program earlier, before the years of the internet, we used to get, and I don't know whether the JI did this, that insert once or a couple of times from the state, the unclaimed property insert. And, you know, people die and whatever, and there's unclaimed property. Well, now that's being administered a different way, but the study or the story that you cite in your column says this might not completely be on the up and up. What's going on here?
Well, the Connecticut Mirror, a couple of weeks ago, did a story reporting that the state treasurer's office is, returning only, 37% of the assets the state claims from banks and insurance companies and things like that when their owners can't be located. You're right. The treasurer's office used to advertise. Mm-hmm. What it called the big list of this unclaimed property. It used to advertise it a lot more vigorously than it does today. But today they don't advertise it so much. And the Mirror reported that 63% of these assets the state has seized are being kept by the state because, in part, the state is not looking too hard for the real owners. I think the the Mirror said that they've taken $2.3 billion in this unclaimed financial property in the last 20 years and kept more than $1.5 billion of it, in part because more than $200 million of it has been used for the public financing campaign for political campaigns. I thought that this was kind of ironic because when we do see the state treasurer Sean Wooden on TV, it's usually in those commercials that he has arranged promoting the state's college savings plan program. Those commercials are financed by a state contractor, so the state doesn't pay for them directly, but it pays for them indirectly, because it's coerced, the treasurer's office has coerced the state contractor to put the commercials together. So the treasurer's put a lot of effort into these commercials that promote him. He appears in the commercials as this conscientious father of the two kids impersonating his sons in the commercial. But the treasurer's office doesn't put half the same interest into publicizing the unclaimed assets. And I thought that was... That was not high class of him.
And Chris, it is interesting because, again, I remember getting in the Sunday paper usually this big insert, and it was pretty easy to see. It was alphabetical, oh, we don't know anything. And granted, Chris, you and I know that sometimes the state can keep that money because there's just no survivors, whether it's land or whether it's a bank account, and probate can't find anybody. So it's your contention then, Chris, that the state isn't really maybe doing a full effort to see if, in fact, there are any extended survivors out there or people with claim to it, or the state is not really initiating maybe another contractor or somebody who could do this?
Yeah, well, you know, you don't have to put the inserts in the newspapers anymore, I'm sorry to say, since I'm in the newspaper business. But, you know, you can put all the names and the amounts on the Internet, and you can put ads in the newspapers or other places saying, hey, go check the list on the treasurer's Internet site. And, you know, that would be very good if you were alerting people that they should do it. But the treasurer's defense here of holding back, two-thirds of this unclaimed property is that state law actually prohibits the treasurer from publicizing unclaimed property worth less than $50. That is, the state doesn't want people to know it has, taken their small amounts. So it's illegal for the treasurer to list, even on the internet, the small amounts. I mean, yeah, the state really is not trying to return this property because it's you know collecting hundreds of millions of dollars every year in unclaimed property, and this is a racket that you know if the treasurer was more public spirited, he would have pointed this out. That you know we're not advertising the unclaimed property enough, and we've prohibited the advertising of unclaimed property under $50, and that's a matter of law. We should change this. We should require greater publicity for the unclaimed property list, and you know we should require publicizing all of it and not exempt the property under $50. But that's you know that's not what the treasurer has done. Instead, he's extorted a state contractor into putting commercials on that are essentially political commercials for his reelection campaign.
Yep. Chris Powell's with us. Chris, hang on. When we come back, we're going to talk to Chris a little more about another point that he recently brought up concerning our Attorney General, William Tong, and his involvement in the continuing opioid litigation. First, traffic and weather together right here on WICC. WICC 600 AM, 107.3 FM, and online at WICC600.com. Coming up next hour, we'll have highlights for you. President Biden in Atlanta today talking about what they're calling now voting reform. They've shifted from voting rights, so he's at the podium right now yelling, pounding the podium, whispering. Chris Powell is with us. Chris is doing none of those three. He's not whispering. He's not yelling. He's not pounding the podium. But Chris continues with us. You also point out something that I was wondering about, Chris, with William Tong, our attorney general, and the continued litigation that is going on against some of the opioid manufacturers. And you point out something, Chris, that I don't hear anybody else mentioning. What is that?
Well, the Attorney General of Connecticut, and I think most of the other attorneys general around the country in the various states, have been suing Purdue Pharma, the pharmaceutical company that made OxyContin, drug that is blamed for you know so much addiction and overdoses and deaths. And you know, there's maybe something to it. My problem is that well, Tong is among the several attorney generals who are objecting to the proposed interstate settlement of the bankruptcy of Purdue Pharma. He argues that the bankruptcy settlement isn't going to get enough money from the Sackler family, which owned OxyContin, and you know he could be right, but the bankruptcy settlement was going to liquidate the company in favor of I guess raising $4 billion or so for victims of OxyContin. Tong is upset that the Sacklers made a lot of money from Purdue Pharma over the years, and supposedly they have billions in their personal accounts. I don't really think it's fair to target the Sacklers. They may all be horrible people. I have no idea. But what's being forgotten here, Paul, is that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved OxyContin for general use in 1985. And ever since then, thousands of doctors went on to prescribe it. Presumably, they knew it had, you know, the risks of addiction. And nobody's suing the FDA, and nobody's suing the doctors who prescribed it. If the FDA had not approved OxyContin, and doctors had not prescribed it, it never would have gotten out of the lab. There's an interesting anecdote in a book about the OxyContin scandal, and that's one of the FDA executives who was involved in getting OxyContin approved. Not long after that, he left the FDA and got hired for a big position at Purdue Pharma for something like $400,000 a year. Now, I would certainly target that conflict of interest at the FDA. I'd wonder why aren't Tong and the other attorneys general suing the FDA for something it did during a Democratic national administration? Why aren't they suing the thousands of doctors who prescribed it? I suspect that the attorneys general are suing only Purdue Pharma because it's very easy to demagogue against drug companies. They're very unpopular. But, you know, if you were going to sue the thousands of doctors in the state of Connecticut who prescribed OxyContin to patients who got addicted or overdosed, well, you know, you'd probably stir up some political controversy here.
Yeah, Chris, that, and believe me, thank you for bringing this up, because I have friends and relatives who have been employed and still are employed by some major drug companies. And you're right. I mean, they've told me over the years, Chris, how, look, it begins and ends with the FDA, as you say. And I have heard from them, the FDA, you know, rejecting applications for this or that because this is too dangerous. That's too dangerous. Too many heart attacks there. Shortness of breath is too high. You've got to go back for more testing. And you're right. Where is the FDA on this? But Chris, like you said, we know who the big target is here.
Well, there's a lot of incestuous relations between the FDA and the pharmaceutical industry. It's something that occurs in all regulatory agencies. It's called regulatory capture. The regulatory agencies end up being controlled by the industries they're supposed to regulate. And I think that may have been what happened here. And in any case, I don't blame the Sacklers. I blame the FDA and the doctors. That OxyContin, it would have been nothing. It would never have been available to the public if the FDA hadn't approved it and if doctors hadn't prescribed it. So why aren't we suing them?
And on that great question, we will wrap up. Always good to hear monthly from Chris Powell, Journal Inquirer of Manchester. Folks, find his stuff online, read it. Clearest thinker in the state. Chris, thank you. Have a good weekend, and we'll chat. Thank you.
Thanks much, Paul.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Good point, folks, right? Right? I mean, again, I've had friends and family members to tell me the influence of the FDA. Did the FDA not think that OxyContin was oxycodone or whatever the various incarnations of it, did they not think there was a chance here for rampant misuse and addiction?